House Labor and Commerce will now come to orders, 3:20 p.m. on Friday, the 7th of March. With us, we have Representative Chenault, Representative Millett, Representative Reinbold, myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum and conduct business, hopefully. We have two excused absences, Representative Herron and Representative Sadler. Let the record reflect that we're going to try to get out of here a little after 5, as close to 5 as we can, because of all the people that are on planes. I've been chastised thoroughly by my committee for even having a meeting today, but thank goodness there are three of them that are around. We have two items on the calendar today, House Bill 247, Peace Officer Firefighter Retirement, and House Bill 316, Workers' Compensation Medical Fees. First up is House Bill 247, and it looks like we've got Grace Abbott and Representative Lindsay Holmes presenting. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a pleasure to be back in the Labor and Commerce Room with you. For the record, my name is Lindsay Holmes. I am the representative from House District 19. And on behalf of myself and my co-prime sponsors, Representative Millett and Representative Ledoux, I want to thank you for taking time to hear this bill, House Bill 247, today.
I think before you get into it, we will adopt the CS as a working document. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute House Bill 247, 28 LS0726, version U, as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Please continue, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my intention is to make a few opening comments and then have Grace Abbott from my office explain the changes in the CS. And then we're going to, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, invite Tom Westcott up to kind of walk through some of the
sure
show. CS. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. We're here today to present a possible plan. The goal is to provide a more secure future for our public safety employees. We're talking about police and fire, the people who protect us. The average hiring age for police officers and firefighters, Mr. Chairman, in the state is 31, and their average age of retirement is 56. So it's generally a shorter career in that area than certain other employees. And the shorter working careers can sometimes leave people with less time in the system and less time to secure their retirement. Defined contribution plans, the current Tier 4 PERS system, definitely has great benefits. One of those is that you and I, as state employees, have access to the SBS, or the Supplemental Annuity Plan, which helps supplement the benefits. Unfortunately, our public safety employees do not have those supplemental benefits, which increases the risk. They have basically the equivalent of what we would know as a 401k program. That's got some great advantages. It's got some risks. So what we hope to do, Mr. Chairman, with this bill is to find sort of a hybrid. It's called a variable benefit. It's sort of an attempt to find a middle ground between the what we would know in this building, sort of a Tier 3 versus a Tier 4, a defined benefit and a defined contribution. It really doesn't follow either of those two paths. And the attempt is to provide reliance in future years on social benefit programs and the difficulty in recruiting and retaining good employees. The proposed plan has some distinct advantages and efficiencies that that go along with defined benefits, such as the ability to pool investment money and therefore get greater returns over time, and security for the employees that they aren't going to run out of money in their later years. But it also has some of the great advantages of a defined contribution plan, such as the fact that it greatly reduces the worry of having the unfunded liability to the state. So it puts a lot more control in the state, security for the state, and more security for the employees. It's an attempt to build a better mousetrap, Mr. Chairman. And with that, you know, we ask you to just consider this plan. The employees who we're talking about here are the police and fire, who put their lives on the line for us and do such a great job. And we would like to take good care of them in return. Thank you for considering this. And with that, if with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll have Grace Abbott explain the changes in the CS.
Well, Grace.
Through the chair, my name is Grace. For the record, my name is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. The CS that you see before you represents just a few changes from the original version, including some additional safeguards for the state. On page 1, lines 5 through 14, we added language to permit the Protective Occupation Retirement Council, which we'll explain in greater detail as we go through the bill, but we wanted to allow them the, or permit them to adjust or deny a monthly cost of living adjustment, or COLA, to ensure the health of our plan. This additional safeguard is intended to protect the plan from becoming...
Grace, excuse me for a minute. We've been joined by Representative Seaton, and would you like to join us at the table, Representative Seaton? And am I missing anybody else in the room? No. Thanks, Grace.
Absolutely. As I was saying, this additional safeguard is intended to protect the plan from becoming underfunded in the event of adverse market experience, as well as to allow a COLA if the health of the fund permits. On page 2, line 24, this change allows the governor to appoint a member of the public at large to serve on the Protective Occupation Retirement Council, which broadens the representation of the public. On page 2, line 17, we clarify that the Protective Occupation Retirement Council may reduce or increase, as the language states, adjust the amount of the annual medical stipend on the health of the fund. And lastly, on page 7, lines 25 through 28, this establishes that the monthly retirement benefit of the Protective Occupation employees cannot exceed Tier 3 benefit levels. So we do not intend for their benefit to supersede that of Tier 3s. The only other changes, Mr. Chairman, in this new version of the bill represent conforming changes.
Any questions for Grace? What's next?
And with that, we'd like to welcome Tom Westcott from the...
Your permission. Yes.
Fiscal note.
We do have two fiscal notes in front of us. We have one that represents a fiscal note from the Department of Administration, Centralized Administrative Services, as well as a fiscal note from the Retirement and Benefits Allocation. And I apologize, the first is from the Office of the Commissioner. And Mr. Chairman, I was not prepared to speak on the fiscal notes today, but we should be joined we are joined by Mike Barnhill from the Department of Administration, who could elaborate further.
Mr. Barnhill.
Do you like us to remain here, or would you like
Certainly.
Us to move him over? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. Happy to answer questions about the fiscal note. There are two. One is the actuarial note. This is the impact from an actuarial perspective on the system. And essentially what we have is an impact to the state in the form of additional state assistance that the state would have to pay under what we call SB 125 from 2008. It starts at, I believe, $3.8 million and grades up to $7.4 million in 2020. The reason why this is the case is somewhat complex, but I'm delighted to report that the actuary that worked with Mr. Westcott and the firefighters on this legislation did come to agreement with our actuary that this fiscal impact looks about what they expected. And if I got that incorrect, folks can clarify that. The reason why there is an impact is the way that we fund state assistance and the past service costs in our PERS system. So recall that we have a very large unfunded liability in the public employee retirement system. It's about $7 billion. And the state provides substantial state assistance to municipalities in paying off that unfunded liability. The way that happens in 2008, we capped the employer contribution rate. The employer contribution rate is the amount, the percentage of the payroll that employers contribute to the public employee retirement system to pay their share of the contributions to fund the eventual benefit. We capped that in 2008 at 22%. The actuarial rate fluctuates, and it's been in the 30% range, and it's now, I believe, 44% for FY15. Within the 22%, the employer contributes, That's allocated in a variety of different ways. So the first allocation of that 22% is for the defined benefit normal costs, and that's roughly about 6% of payroll. The second allocation is for defined contribution costs, and that the employer contributes on behalf of defined contribution employees, and there's a number of components. 5% the employer contributes of payroll, and the employee gets that in their account that they can manage and invest as they wish. Then there's 3%, roughly, that goes to a health reimbursement arrangement account that is for the employee to use when they retire, and they can use that health reimbursement arrangement to pay for their premium share of retiree medical premium and for any deductibles and other medical care. So that's 5 plus 3, that's 8%. Then there is the employer major medical contribution to the employee's health care. That's about 1.5%. And then the remaining amount is the employer contribution for occupational death and disability. And for the police fire, that's about 1%. If you add all those up, that's about 9% of within that 22% that goes to the defined contribution normal cost. Now, that's computed on the basis, it gets really complicated, I apologize. It's computed on the basis of the defined contribution payroll only. When you compute it on the basis of the total payroll, that 9% reduces to about 4%. So 5% for the employee's account, 3% for the health reimbursement arrangement, another 4% for defined contribution, and I'm getting this all mixed up. In any event, when you take that and you do what this bill does, you take those employees out of the defined contribution and you put them into Tier 5, as the sponsor has indicated, the contribution costs increase for the employer from around 9% to 14% for peace fire and 12% for those non-peace fire staff in the Department of Public Safety. Those costs increase, and therefore the remaining amount within the 22%, which normally go to past service costs, decrease, which means the state has to pick up more past service costs. I'll pause. That was confusing. Do you want me to try again?
That'd be great.
Okay.
But if we ended up ultimately picking up all 42 or 43% of the people that are in Tier 4 now, it would be significantly higher?
It would be higher if you put more Tier 4 folks into this, for sure. Absolutely. The bottom line is that we are paying more for this portion of the population within the 22% cap. When you pay more, the amount that goes to past service costs decreases. The state has to pick that up. The actuaries estimate that's going to start at 3.8 million and go up to 7.4 over a period of 6 years.
And I've got a quick question on that point for the, sure, the sponsor, Ms. Abbott. Have you been contacted by a number of unions that wish to participate in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there have been some inquiries into our office as to what the plan does or doesn't, and some inquiries.
Thanks. Any questions for Mr. Barnhill?
I have one on the second fiscal note.
Representative Millen.
Thank you. Mr. Barnhill, I was looking at the second fiscal note, the admin fiscal note. Can you talk about the differences? Grace pulled up the SB 141 fiscal note for me for Tier 4. And it was different, much different than this fiscal note for going to Tier 5. Can you tell us the differences between why there would be such a difference in cost between Tier 4 and then going to Tier 5?
Through the chair, Representative, I haven't looked at that fiscal note in a while, but what I can tell you is the difference between the two proposals is that in the proposal before the committee, we're putting individuals who elect into this into two tiers at the same time. So they remain in Tier 4 for purposes of putting the credit associated with overtime into an investment account that they can invest. And then for all other credit, it goes into a defined benefit account in Tier 5. So for our system, for the first time, we're having to reprogram it so that it can accommodate an individual being in two tiers at the same time. We've never had that before, and so we anticipate that's going to take a substantial amount of reprogramming in order to accommodate two tiers at once.
Okay.
follow-up?
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Barnhill, that's a great explanation, but when I looked at the analysis for both the SB 141 and this bill, they're exactly the same. So I don't understand how the cost would be so different. And we're talking about, I mean, in this one, they actually put down that they need cubicles, which wasn't in SB 141. They did say they needed two non-permanent employees. They did need someone to reprogram the computers, but, I mean, I guess I'm confused. I mean, we're basically doing the same thing as we did as 141, adding another tier, you know, an opportunity to have another tier. So I guess I'm the disparity in costs. I've asked our financial group, David Teal, to look at the costs and see if there's a discrepancy in what admin says, what you say, and what really the costs are. Because I would imagine. I mean, this should be the same as SB 141, but I could be wrong. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. Through the chair, there are similar things. When you add a new tier, you're going to need additional staff support, whatever, in order to administer the tier. But the fundamental difference is this bill adds another tier while leaving these people in the existing tier. And so that is different. It's fundamentally different. We've never had a pension plan proposal where we leave people in two tiers, and that requires the additional work, and so therefore it's fundamentally different than anything the legislature has considered in the past.
Follow up. I just find it funny that you need more cubicles, Mr. Barnhill, after your new space requirements.
Well, through the chair, Representative Millett, I wish I could come before you and tell you that it's easy to administer a pension plan. Unfortunately, it requires staff. It's incredibly complex. When we get data, we don't get data from one employer in the state of Alaska. We get data from 200 some employers. The data comes in on a weekly basis. People come in and out of different tiers in this bill, right? So a secretary can be in tier 5 in DPS. Then if that secretary moves to the Department of Law, then that secretary will then move back to tier 4, and we've got people bouncing in and out of tiers. People come in and out of leave status. People come in and out of employment status. And we have to track all of that eligibility so that the records are accurate at that point in time when they retire, so that we've accurately computed their service credit so that they can retire. And it's just complex. It takes staff. It takes time. It takes cubicles.
Certainly.
So, Mr. Barnhill, I am a Tier 2 employee, but when I came back as a legislature, I had the opportunity to go into Tier 4. So was it complicated for me to go into Tier 4 after I went from Tier 2?
Well, through the chair, this is fun.
This is so much fun for me. You have no idea.
It's less complex in that hypothetical because you're not staying in Tier 2 and Tier 4 at the same time. But with this bill...
I am. Well, I have Tier 2. I completed my... I vested in Tier 2. I'm sorry, through the chair. I vested in Tier 2. And then when I came back as a legislator 6 years ago, I chose a 401k plan.
Okay. So fair enough. So you have vested in Tier 2, but your accumulating service credit currently is not going into Tier 2 and Tier 4 at the same time, which this bill does. Right, so you are a peace officer at the Department of Public Safety, and you do overtime. That overtime, so for part of the week, your service credit is going into Tier 5, and for part of the week, your service credit is going into Tier 4. That's the difference.
Mr. Chairman, if I may interject, we could, we could put the overtime into Tier 5, but... It's an attempt to avoid overtime spiking.
And absolutely. There's a good reason for what they're doing here. I'm not quarreling with the good objective to prevent spiking. I'm just saying it's complicated.
Most good things are.
Any questions?
So it's this complicated that we have a $1.6 million fiscal note for the department admin to readjust our computers and change from Tier 4 to Tier 5 because there's people going back and forth, like me, that's going from Tier 3 or from Tier 2 to Tier 4.
Through the chair, it's this complicated, but it's not like you. It is.
<it's different. laughs> You knew this would be fun.
You told me it would be.
You declared it. Thanks again, Mr. Barnhill.
Anytime.
We'll let you off the hook now. Any questions for the sponsor or Grace before we go on to open it up to Tom Westcott?
I'd like us to...
Well, you guys are getting off easy. Oh, Representative Chenault.
We're not running away.
Mr. Chairman, just for a quick comment, I didn't notice that Mr. Barnhill had got away from the table.
Man.
Oh.
On the other fiscal note, which has a lot more numbers in it than the one does, has the actuarial actually ran a computation of what the actual cost of this program would be spread over time? I see that it basically doubles in 6 years or in 5 years, and I would be curious just to know what it would be over the life of the employees that are affected by it.
Through the chair, Representative Speaker Chenault, I believe the actuary has. So the cost would be for a peace firefighter 14% of that DC payroll, and that DC payroll is going to grow over time. So you have to compare that to the existing cost of the Tier 4 population, which is around 9 to 10%. So it goes from 9 to 10% to 14% for the peace officer fire. And then for the staff and DPS, it's 12%. And I should make the point that, I'll just leave it at that. I do believe the actuary can run those numbers very easily if they haven't done so already.
So if you do that for us, please, we can get them out to the committee and the bill sponsors.
Chairman Olson. And was Mercer your consultant?
Through the chair, Mercer was our consultant until, I believe, 2007.
I believe about the time they paid us $500 million.
So that was 2010. Yeah, I was just clarifying the time was. Yeah, no, Buck Consultants did this.
Any further questions before we let Mike leave again?
Yeah, that's
right. It would be.
Well, it could be there.
Are you leaving?
I'm just going to go over here.
Thanks again.
That, Mr. Chairman?
With
cede the table? With your permission?
Yes.
We won't go away either, though.
we'll call you if we need you.
Yes.
Come on up, Mr. Westcott.
Hey, you got startup costs.
No. Thanks, startup costs.
Come on.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Tom Westcott, President of Alaska Professional Firefighters. I wanted to provide a little bit of background on this plan. We've listened to the debate, the DC-DB debate that's gone on since 2006 with regard to this issue. And over the last 24 months, we've kind of looked around and listened to both sides and realized that both sides had some valid points, but that maybe there was a better way to do it. We looked around to the successful plans around the country, the Wisconsins, the Washington states, and tried to steal what it is that they did that made their plan successful. So with the goal of creating self-sufficient retirees who are able to exit a career, a physically strenuous career at an appropriate time, we crafted the variable benefit retirement plan. So in my presentation, I hope to illustrate a couple things. Number one, that we think Tier 4 has some areas where it's lacking, especially related to our career field. And then I want to explain kind of the solution that we've come up with. So Mr. Barnhill talked extensively about the employer's 22% contribution and where it all goes. And as you can see on this pie chart here, Tier 4 tries to do a lot of things with the health retirement account, with a 401, K, and then occupational death and disability and post-Medicare health insurance. But even if you add up all those things, the big thing Tier 4 does with that employer contribution is it goes to pay off the unfunded unfunded liability associated with tiers 1 through 3 that the tier 4 participants do not participate in at all. They see no benefit in that money. So that creates some problems, and we'll see this slide again later. But basically, when you look at that average firefighter who comes into service, or police officer, 30, 31, and exits 55, 60, they get about a 30-31% income replacement in Tier 4. Now, this is compounded by the fact that they do not have Social Security in many cases and don't have SBS. Traditionally, public safety employees have not participated in Social Security because they don't work till Social Security age. They've participated in pension systems where that money's been dedicated towards pension systems that will allow for an earlier retirement appropriate with the strenuous nature of the work.
If I can cut in on that, I believe there are 90 political subdivisions around the state that still participate in Social Security and PERS and TERS.
There certainly are some that do. That's correct. There, but if you look at places like Kenai or Anchorage or Fairbanks, they have neither. And there's other ones out there, but just those are some examples.
Both of those are in my district, and I am familiar with them because I worked with them when they opted out. They opted out at different times, but the Kenai Peninsula Borough, for example, and I believe the school district has stayed in. So we have the borough is still participating, and I believe the borough is the largest of the 90, but we've got small towns all around the state, medium size, but I believe the borough is probably the largest. But when the cities opted out, it was for various reasons. I know that NEA opted out at, or their predecessor opted out at statehood because they didn't want their people paying twice, which I'm guessing is the reason why a lot of people did it. And at that point in time, everybody was real young and was going to be around forever and didn't think about retirement and didn't want to pay the 6 or 7%. But at, oftentimes it was at the request of the employees when they opted out. And I believe Lisa Murkowski has been working for years to allow the communities one more chance to go back in, but I haven't heard anything in the last couple of years on that. But yeah, it is one leg of the stool that's gone for a lot of people.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. There are people in and out. I think most people, when they did opt out, opted out when they were covered under defined benefit pension plans. So that certainly influenced their decision at the time that they did opt out. There was no reconsideration, I guess, at the time that Tier 4 was came into play. So on the next slide, some of the things we believe, some of the shortcomings, areas where we think we could improve on Tier 4. And the first is a lack of professional money management. In Tier 4, individuals, it's up to the individual to make all the investment decisions. If they want their money managed, then they have to pay a fee, which takes away from their eventual retirement savings. All the risk is at the individual level. So when we see, you know, instances like 2008 or 2000 through 2003, if that's in your career, that's pretty shocking towards your retirement savings. So one of the things that we correct in our plan is all the risk being at the individual level. Insufficient funding. When Tier 4 was built, it's a 5% contribution from the employer, goes into an employee's 401A. In reading, TIA CREF put out a paper on the best practices for defined contribution plans. This is a financial institution pushing defined contribution plans. And their recommendation was a 20% contribution for individuals not covered by Social Security. And for public safety, it would have to be well north of that because of shorter, to account for shorter careers. We are currently at 13%, with 8 of that coming from the employee. The health savings that individuals are accumulating in the HRA are not projected to cover health care costs. And again, we're talking about a population that tends to retire earlier and therefore need pre-Medicare coverage more so than others. And we hit on this a little bit, the market corrections, they're certainly very severe on the individual level and can be very shocking. And then the last thing is higher fees. You certainly get the economies of scale like the PFD, the permanent fund enjoys, or that the current money invested by the onboard, they pay lower fees than the individual pays.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, are you analyzing this as the individual having control to make their individual investments instead of the, like the SBS, having to choose among market managers?
Well, under Tier 4, you can make your own investment decisions. So theoretically, you could have two individuals with the same income, work the same period of time, invest in different ways, and come out with different benefits at the end of their career because of bad choices or good choices. If they were adverse to risk and they were in fixed income type investments, they would earn a lower rate of return. So you could have identical people getting a much different benefit at the end of their career.
Well, I guess, so you're talking about choosing the investment strategy, not doing the individual investments?
Through the chair. In our plan, what we're trying to adopt is the professional money management, just like the onboard. They hire professionals, just like the permanent fund, you hire professionals to manage that money. I'm sorry if I'm not getting your question correctly.
New question.
Yeah, thank you. I was just trying to figure out whether the options that they have, which are the basically the same as the SBS managers, are inadequate or how you're looking at that as being individual investments and individual stock purchases and those kind of things makes it more variable?
Through the chair, I'm not completely familiar with SBS because I don't participate in that, but under Tier 4, individuals can choose a host of mutual funds. It's not individual stocks or anything like that, and to make their investments. Or they can pay to have their account managed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
So some of the consequences that were highlighted actually in the best practices for DC paper, and I'm happy to provide that to anyone who would like to see a copy.
Yeah, send a copy of that to Conrad at the committee. We'll get it out to all the members and anybody else that calls the office.
Thank
and
you.
Sponsors.
Thank you.
And Sharice will get one twice.
So we have the probability of an aged workforce. Individuals, as they get further on in their career, will be forced to make decisions on whether to stay or not based on financial reasons. Sometimes those are reasonable decisions that one has to make. But when you couple that with the physical nature of the job and the stresses that puts on an individual, employers can see things like workers' comp increases, and in the worst-case scenario, you can see things like death due to somebody sticking around maybe a little longer than they should have. We also have difficulty in recruitment and retention. While DC plans are gaining in popularity, for police and fire, we are competing against the rest of the country, and there's few and far between that have strictly DC plans similar to Alaska. And if we don't get the DC plan right, I'm not here to say that it's impossible to make a DC plan succeed, but if you don't get it right and the individual runs out of money, there's going to be a burden on the social welfare system. We're a country that's going to take care of the elderly, and if I was a Tier 4 member and at age 80 I ran out of money, I don't have Social Security, I live to 88. Somebody is going to pick up the tab in between there. So the solution we crafted provides to our members the distinct advantages and efficiencies of a defined benefit and provides the state fiscal discipline and control of funding. It's similar to a DC plan. It's a flat rate. And what we ask for is the 14 and 12, like Mr. Barnhill pointed out earlier. And then we manage this plan without asking for more money by altering benefits as opposed to asking for more money in the future. So if we have adverse market experience, we alter the benefits. And I can go into that more as we go through. There's a portion that is, just like the title says, variable in nature. So the advantage we would get with this plan is we'd get professional money management, lower fees. We get long-term investment strategies. And one thing I pointed out, that an individual has one career. And if in that career you're going to retire in 2009, well, it was disastrous. You know, maybe if you retired in 99, maybe it worked out. It just depends. A large pooled account has time on its side, so it can recover better than the individual. We pool risks among the participants of the plan instead of all at the individual level. And then at the end, our members will get one form of stable and predictable retirement income. This isn't everything. It doesn't absolve them of the responsibility of saving in a 401k or a 457 to supplement this. This isn't providing 100% of income or anything like that. This is just one stable, you know, they used to say the three-legged stool. This is kind of returning one leg of that stool. So in the next chart, I kind of, this is a very, the bill is very complicated. And so what we went down is we took the chart that Division and Retirements and Benefits created to explain the tiers, and we kind of put our tier over under the variable benefit retirement system. And then we kind of cited the page in the bill of how you get to those benefits. And I can walk everyone through that if you're interested. I'll get to a slide here in a little while that will kind of really maybe highlight the difference in an easier fashion.
Why don't you give us a short version so we'll have time for Mr. Fournier.
Okay.
Is on hold.
The big difference in our plan is there's a portion of benefits that are guaranteed, and then there's a benefit level that's targeted. And however we experience actually works out, that's where we pay. And so we fund the plan. The plan is built on providing Tier 3 type benefits, but we leave ourselves significant room that if we don't, things don't work out the way we think they're going to work out or the way we want them to work out, we have room to make adjustments as opposed to going back to the employer and asking for more money. Some of the safeguards, Mr. Barnhill again talked about this extensively. The OT does not count in final calculations. One of the problems with pension systems that we've seen in the past was overtime spiking. Individual would make a certain amount of money most of their career and then spike it considerably for their, you know, high 3 years and then retire on a pension that was much higher than what they actually earned. So what we did in this plan is we said all contributions on overtime will go into a DC account and will not count in the final calculation. So I think Mr. Barnhill said you participate in two tiers. I don't think that's quite correct. There is a DC component and the variable component side, but we're not still getting the contribution on the DC side, so we're not actually still in Tier 4. But we do have DC accounts. The only contributions that go in there are the ones on overtime, and that's just so overtime is not calculated in the final equation for your pension. We also added minimum requirements for age, 55 for public safety and 60. The old PERS tiers did not have. They were just based age requirements. They were just based on time. And we built this plan with a 7% rate of return as opposed to an 8. We just used a more conservative rate. Some of the other things we did is employee contributions are adjustable. We made the post-pension adjustment and the COLA. We want to make those optional, and they're based on the funding status of the plan. And then there's a variable benefit that is optional, and the board can award that based on the health of the plan. And then last, we guarantee the 2013 premium, and I think the best way to explain this is we used a number of 1647, which is what healthcare cost in 2013. So if you imagine you have a line, and on the left side is $1,647, and 30 years from there, you have the number that healthcare actually costs. We hope we're over here, but if we're not, we only pay out somewhere in the middle there. So we'd like healthcare to keep up with inflation, and we've built it to keep up with inflation, but if it doesn't, we're just not able to slide that 1647 as far to the right as we'd like to. And so, as opposed to the old tiers where they promised health care regardless of cost, we promised a stipend. So on the PERS benefits compared to the variable benefit, the big thing is as you look through that, you can see the portion on a 25-year employee. Under Tier 3, you would get 57%. Under our tier, you would get 50%. And the variable portion would be 7%. Everything goes great, you still get 57%. Things don't go so well, they have that 7.5% to work with to bring down your benefit. COLA and post-pension retirement adjustments also fit into that as a tool to adjust. And then, as I explained in the medical, you have that tool on the medical also. Some of the, we looked around at private sector and public sector employees or employers and what they were contributing towards retirement. You can look at the numbers there. We're right in the ballpark. And even what other states have done when they've modified their pension plans. So in closing, I would just like to stress again that due to the unique nature of the career, the shorter time frame, the lack of SBS for a lot, the lack of Social Security for a lot of us, there are some shortfalls with Tier 4 and what it's projected to pay at retirement. We think we've come up with a really good solution that is a compromise that addresses a lot of the concerns that people, legitimate concerns that individuals have expressed about unfunded liabilities, and we hope to continue to work on this plan and address anyone's concerns that they have.
Representative Millett.
Thanks, Tom, for being here. Do you guys, since SB 141 passed, did you guys do a retention study? The union, did you and the peace officers do a what the turnover rate has been since SB 141 and prior to SB 141?
Through the chair, I have seen some numbers that the on board had and that Mr. Barnhill had years ago. I have not seen it currently. Derek Scher from the police department is here, and he can certainly probably speak more about the issues that they're having in the police department with...
Well, I know someone did a study, Chairman Olson. I would be interested to see in what the retention... has been since SB 141 passed, since we went to a Tier 4 for peace officers.
I can only speak for my community. I check with both of my cities, the borough and the school district, several times a year on this issue since we made the conversion. And anecdotally, it appears to me that the younger firefighters and police officers that are coming in like the new plan, the real young ones. And I don't know age-wise if that's in their 20s, mid-20s, late 20s, but they apparently like the portability of it and the fact that they do have a little bit of control over it and they vest sooner.
And follow up with that? I guess that's one of my problems with this is if they want it portable, that means they're going to leave. So we're training them, and then they leave. So that's the cost of the state that's not added to this package of what we're doing here. Training costs are extremely expensive for any peace officer. I think the training academy at Sitka will tell you that their training costs are above $100,000 per officer. So I guess that's something that would have to be equated in, even at the younger firefighters and peace officers that are coming in. They like the portability because they're getting trained and leaving. And that's what I would be interested in hearing.
Well, on that point, I ask more than one question when I interview all of them. And the second question I ask is, during the exit interviews, why are people leaving? And actually, I would suspect this is probably not as limited to the Kenai Peninsula, but a lot of people leave because one spouse or the other spouse doesn't like Alaska. The second reason is that they've had an illness or medical condition with family members outside, and they move out. But so far, at least in my area, the retirement plan has not been a significant factor. Again, that's just my area, and it's anecdotal.
But in my district, it's completely the opposite. It's that when I ride along with the firemen or the police officers that are younger, that are less than 4 years in service, they just say, well, we came for training and experience, and then we're out of here because the 401k plan is just not worth us staying around for. But the training was. And so that's my fear is what we're doing is we're training a lot of people for other police force or a lot of other fire departments and a lot of other state troopers. So that I guess that's something that I would hope that we would take into consideration as the training cost for these people, because it's not cheap to continue training, to start training. And so anecdotal information is great, but I'd love some statistical information on that if you guys.
Actually, we'll get whatever Mike and Tom can provide, and we'll get them out to not only the members but the sponsors. And any further questions for Tom? Seeing none, we're going to go off now. Thanks again, Tom.
Thank you very much.
William Fournier, are you online?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for joining us today. We can hear you fine. Thank you for joining us, and please state your name and affiliation. It's all yours for the next few minutes.
Thank you. My name is William Fournier. I'm a credential actuary, a fellow of the Society of Actuaries with my own firm, Pension Trustee Advisors, and I've been engaged by the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association along with the police union to analyze this plan and to give them some guidance on how you might want to design it. I've testified previously to your Senate, I believe it was 2 years ago. I've also testified in Utah, Colorado, Rhode Island, New Mexico, North Dakota, as well as city councils, Atlanta, Memphis, Oakland, and several others. I have a pretty broad amount of experience. I work for both labor unions occasionally. I work for pension funds. I work for city and state governments. And I work, I'm currently working in both the Detroit bankruptcy and the Stockton bankruptcy for bondholders. So I really have experience on all sides of these issues. And I can see that my presentation is up. So why don't we start going through that? I'm happy to take questions as we go along, if that is your desire.
No, it'll certainly be fine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's go to the page that page two. Basically, I'm going to talk about why it's necessary to make some kind of a change. We'll talk a little bit about the structure of how this plan is going to work, and then I've got some examples both from other states as well as examples of what would have happened if we'd started this plan in 1963 or 1986 or 1996, and hopefully that will be illustrative of how this works. Now, Mr. Westcott and even Mr. Barnhill and actually all four of the witnesses have covered some of this, so I will move quickly through the areas that you've already seen. Okay, page 3 is a chart here, and let's focus on the police and fire column because most of the members of this program would be police and firefighters. The typical retirement age or higher age has been age 31, and the typical retirement age, or the average retirement age, has been age 56 with 25 years of service. And as Mr. Westcott showed you, under the old Tier 3 provisions, that police officer or firefighter would receive a benefit at age 56 of 57% of pay, actually 57.5% of pay. And then I've done some calculations that, based on the 13% that's going into the Tier 4, which I'm calling DCR here, it's a defined contribution retirement, is an acronym that's occasionally used, I calculate 31%. I'll talk in a little bit why it's so much lower. But basically what this means is that for your police and firefighters, if they had had a choice between Tier 3 and Tier 4, you know, the benefits, you know, a little better than half under the Tier 4. And then back to the portability issue that was discussed a few minutes ago, you know, from an actuarial point of view, and I know most police and firefighters think like police officers and firefighters, not like actuaries, but from an actuarial point of view, the best thing they could do is come up to Alaska, bank a bunch of money for 5 or 6 years in this DCR plan, and go down to Washington State or my state of Colorado or wherever and join a true defined benefit plan, you know, get 20 years on, and then retire under that plan. That is strategically the smartest thing to do. So it doesn't surprise me that the younger police and firefighters like this plan, but they like it now. In 5 or 10 years, when they don't have as much future time to bank up their money, they won't like it as much. Let's go to page 4.
If I can cut in for a minute on page 3. Is there any chance of extending that out one more column for the committee and putting in the private sector for the average ages and retirement age and as many of the blanks as you can fill in, just to give us a perspective on a broader basis?
Yeah, like a typical private sector plan?
Yeah.
Would you want a public safety type position or labor type position, or would you want a...
How about an average private sector?
Just yeah, well, the average private sector worker is not a police and firefighter, so it would be more like the other PERS column. And I'll just give you some of these off the top of my head. You know, they'd come in probably in their mid-30s. If they did retire, they'd probably have to work till 62, 65. They don't have a pension, so there would be no Tier 3 type row. They would have a DCR benefit that's a little, probably a little better than yours because they would be saving on their own in their company 401k. And then since they're older, it would be a little better. So it'd probably be maybe 40% of pay, something like that, from their 401k plan. But what's happening is, you know, in the real world is these people aren't retiring because they haven't saved up enough. So, you know, we could simulate that they would retire, say, at 62 or 65. And I'd be happy to do that comparison. But the numbers would probably be in the 40% range for that.
Yeah, if it's not
second to bottom, bro.
It'd be appreciated. Thanks. Now, please continue.
Okay, so page 4, and Tom showed you this already. These calculations are consistent with what you just saw on page 3. So let me skip this page unless there was a question on this one. Page 5 is a lot of words on this. It's just the pre-Medicare piece. Part of the Tier 4 contribution is going into this health retirement account. And so we just did an example of someone that's that was hired at 32, is now 36, is going to retire, in this case at 57. They need 8 more years to cover their Medicare. But basically we've projected up their 3% contributions and discover they only have enough to pay for about 30% of the health insurance costs, you know, member plus spouse. So they'd have to find some other sources to pay for the remaining 70% of health care costs.
Mr. Fournier, we had a question on page 4 from Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Do
Just a real quick question. It says an average of $80,000 final average salary. After how many years would that be?
This would be someone retiring after 25 years. And this is all in today's dollars. But I have to confess, I don't recall if I got the $80,000 from the actual participant information you have. But the two middle bar, the two left-hand bars, Tier 3 DB and Tier 4 DC, the shape is identical, whether it's $80,000 final salary or $800,000 final salary. It's just the scale. Social Security obviously varies a little bit. On, you know, a lower paid person would have a higher Social Security benefit relative to the others. Does that answer your question?
Good enough.
Okay, so basically, page 5 just was demonstrating that the Medicare, if you do retire at 56, 57 or so, with, you know, 8 or 9 years of pre-Medicare needs, you're gonna have a tough time with just this 3% HRA contribution. Page 6 now, shifting gears, just the general pros and cons of the two types of programs, defined benefit and defined contribution. And keep in mind what this bill is proposing is something truly in between. It's trying to take some of the advantages of both and craft them into a plan. The defined benefit plans are a more cost-effective way for the taxpayer dollar to pay for retirement benefits for three reasons. One is that each individual doesn't know how long they're going to live. So when they've built up their defined contribution account, if they were to build up a defined contribution account, they would have to kind of hedge against living longer than average. And so they would, they don't know how long, because they don't know how long they're going to live, they will be drawing down their accounts more slowly than they could have, whereas a pooled account, like Mr. Barnhill manages, their actuary has a pretty good idea of knowing how long the average people live. I mean, they don't know who's going to die when, but they know how many are going to die in general. So they can just, the benefits are pooled, they can pay out just as long as they live. So under the DB approach, the typical person dies with some balance left in their, I'm sorry, under the DC approach rather, the typical retiree dies with some balance left over for their children. Now that's great for their children, but it's not an efficient use of the dollars that are going into the plan. It's paying a life insurance benefit instead of a pension benefit. The second advantage, and I'll start moving a little more quickly if that's desired. The second advantage is that individuals, as they get older, can't take the investment risk. You know, the ARM board, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, has a long time horizon, and they can take a lot more investment risk than an 80-year-old retired firefighter can.
Representative
Yes, please.
We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
I was somewhat confused on the more cost-effective on the DB plan. I mean, the problem is with our DB plans is they're have this huge amount of unfunded liability as plans all across the nation do. So how is that more cost effective for the state if it hasn't worked out that the amounts that was contributed under the plan paid for the plan and we're now having to pay for DB? How's that more cost effective?
Through the chair, excellent question. Two answers. One is, it's cost effective if you do it right, and we're going to structure this plan so that we're doing it right. But the second issue is, if all the money that you, if you'd been DC all along, you would, the unfunded liability would still be the same, it would just be now on the backs of your workers. So your workers would not have a guaranteed retirement. Your retirees that have overspent their savings, you know, would not have much pension left or much savings left, so the unfunded liability, which is now the responsibility of the state and the employers, if you had been DC all along, would have been just deficits in the abilities for the individuals to retire, or in a more serious case, deficits in the accounts of people that have already retired.
So as representatives of the state trying to construct a plan that's fiscally responsible, and if the defined benefit plan created $15 billion or so of liabilities for the state, I'm trying to, again, figure out how that's more, can be described as more cost-effective for the state. You're saying, well, did I misunderstand?
Well, you would have just paid less. You would have not been providing adequate retirement benefits. If you had wanted to have provided the adequate retirement benefits for these people under the DC program, you would have had to have made a lot higher contributions. You're probably looking at the bottom of my slide, because that's the big advantage of the DC plan, is there's no risk at all of the employer having an unfunded liability under the, but any shortfalls just get shifted to the backs of the employees. So, you know, under the current structure, the Tier 1 and 2 and 3 DB plans, you know, you are providing adequate retirement benefits for these folks. You're doing it at a cost of having a big unfunded liability, but you are providing an adequate retirement. If you had wanted to provide an adequate retirement through a DC program, you would have spent the same or more money. You would have just had to have paid more earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to just figure it out, and it seems like if we're spending the money at the time that we're employing people, we can at least schedule that in and decide how many employees we can have and how much wages we can have. But if we don't know what the future cost is going to be, it's very difficult. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And through the chair, that's exactly why we're structuring the plan this way, because this is a legitimate concern you have. You've got a big unfunded liability. You wish you didn't have it. This variable plan is specifically designed to capitalize upon the three advantages at the top and maintain many of the advantages at the bottom of this slide, but in particular the bottom bullet, the no risk of unfunded liabilities to the employer. And let me go ahead and finish the defined contribution advantages. Tom talked a little bit about the third DB advantage. But moving from the bottom, as we've just discussed, under a DC plan, there's no risk of unfunded liabilities. The DC benefit is much more portable. It's a lot easier for a mid-career police officer or firefighter to take their money with them if it's under a DC arrangement. It's under their full control, which is why they like it. And it's very transparent, very clear to them what they're getting. And frankly, it's very clear to the state and the municipalities what they're paying in these plans. Let's look at page 7. So basically, this bill is what we call striking a compromise. We're going to take the key feature of the DC plan, that the key advantage is the employer knows exactly what the cost is going to be. There's going to be no future unfunded liabilities. So we start with that fixed contribution, and then we agree to manage that plan within that budget of that employer contribution. We design target benefit levels, which are basically the same as the Tier 3, but we build in adjustment mechanisms. So we start with much lower guaranteed benefit levels, and Tom showed some of those. I'll show some more. And then from the actuarial side, we use the lower discount rate to build in a little bit of a cushion against future adverse experience. If our bogey is only 7% before we start trying to improve benefits, or, you know, back up, build, improve benefits back up to the target level, then, you know, it'll be a little easier to do. Page 8. And this is consistent with the fiscal note numbers that Mike Barnhill was saying about an hour ago. And I got to tell you, yeah, Mike's absolutely right. This stuff is kind of complicated. If we look at the two right-hand columns, we can see where the fiscal note came from. Basically, under the proposed variable benefit plan, 14% of the 22 is going towards pensions you know, pension and health care benefits, and 8% is going to the unfunded liabilities. But under the current, the middle column, which is the tier four, as Mike was saying, you've got 5% to the defined, to the pension accounts, the DCR accounts. You've got 3% to the health retirement account. 2.72 is towards other liabilities, which is the death, disability, and post-65 health care. So the total is 11.28. And also, I'm sorry, also as Mike mentioned, his actuary's numbers are slightly different, but we're pretty much in the same ballpark. So since only 11.28 goes to the, I'm sorry, since, yeah, 11.28% of the payroll of the people that we're talking about goes towards the legacy unfunded liabilities, the tier 1, 2, and 3 unfunded liabilities under tier 4, while only 8% go to unfunded liabilities under our proposal, that means the state has to pick up the extra 3.28, or his actuary said more like 3.98% of pay for the unfunded liabilities. So that's where the fiscal note comes from, the big part of the fiscal note. It's that difference between the 8 that we now will have versus the 11.28, which we have today. And then I believe another question was on the fiscal note. Yeah, it was starting a little under $4 million. Been working on bigger cases lately. $4 million and going up to 7.8, I think it was. The reason that's going up so rapidly is because you're hiring people and you've got more people going into this tier. At some point, not long after it hits the 7.8, everybody, or virtually everybody, will be in this new tier, and it will stabilize and only go up by, you know, 3 or 4% a year as your average payroll goes up. So the increase in cost is quite significant. I mean, for example, in the first year, if you'd started this in 2005, the cost would have doubled as you'd had 2 years of people instead of one. So I expect when Mr. Barnhill comes back with the expanded fiscal note information, you'll see that it goes up somewhat steeply for the next 5 or 6, 7, 10 years, and then kind of stabilizes. So page 9 is the same as page 8, only it's for the non-police and fire members, and I suspect you're not interested in going through this in detail because it's very similar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton.
So the contributions for the non-police and fire members, why are those members different than those same jobs in throughout the entire PERS field? Or did I misunderstand that?
Through the chair, could you repeat the question first? I think I might have misunderstood what you said.
So the contribution for non-police and fire members, is that everybody in the PERS system throughout all state employees?
Through the chair, the two left-hand columns are everybody throughout the PERS, but the right-hand column, we're only covering, I believe, individuals working in protective occupations that are I don't know the exact right words, but basically non-police, non-fire. So maybe secretaries, maybe dispatchers. I don't know all your job titles.
Mr. Chairman? Thank you. I guess what I'm trying to find out the rationale for having this system have this higher percentage towards pension for the secretaries that are, or dispatchers or other people within the police fire category that would be doing the same job descriptions as other PERS employees throughout the state hire system.
Through the chair, this might be a better question for Ms. Abbott or Mr. Westcott. I believe it's a fairly small group, and perhaps it's just convenience of the department, but I don't know precisely the logic for why we were including a small number of other people that are non-public safety in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it'd better to wait for somebody
to this point.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Well, because, well, first off, what I believe is that because they belong to the same union, but the reason that we're talking about this group of people is today, I guess about a half an hour ago, Senior Captain Jeff Bayless passed away on duty, fire captain on duty, lost his life. And I can go through the police officers at APD that got shot for the last two or three years. So I think when we talk about why this group is special, it's because they're laying down their lives for us. And so they are different type of people than the people that we go to at DMV. They're not putting their lives on the line to give us driver's license. And we have a distinction between public safety peace officers and other state workers. So I guess when I signed onto this bill, I mean they belong to the union and so they're part of the group that is there that takes that type of administrative officers to help run the fire department, and then they're covered in that union. But for me, this bill is about covering people that will put their lives on the line, like Captain Bayless, who lost his life about 30 minutes ago. You know, first time in a long time we've lost a fireman on duty. And in the last 3 years, we've had three police officers in my APD department get shot. And so when we talk about this bill, I think I hope we're thinking about the people that put their lives on the lines and not comparing them to people that work at DMV, not saying that they're less honorable or less thought, but they're not out there every night and every day carrying guns and protecting you and I from the crap that's out there. I mean, go do a ride-along, and you find out what they do. So why we're talking about this is that's why we're talking about this, is because it's a completely different line of work than your regular state worker.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton. I was not talking about the folks on the left-hand column, the police officers and the firefighters. I was talking about the non-officer category that we have in here, and I'm trying to figure out how we equate those with the differential that would be going to the 12%, not the 14% that is in the other category. So I was wondering what that was. So
I'd like to get back on point. Mr. Fournier has about 15 minutes left.
Sure.
And can you continue, please, Mr. Fournier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, let's move on to page 10 then, please. So the idea here is that we want safeguards. We want safeguards to make sure this plan is adequately funded, because the plan is built around the state or the employer contribution being fixed at 12% or 14%, and then no do-over, no re-bargain, nothing like your current plan where you, surprise, surprise, you've got an unfunded liability. This plan is designed to make the pension council make tough decisions to keep the plan adequately funded and manage benefits so that we can do that. So we're doing this in several ways. We're using a lower actuarial rate. Overtime, as we discussed, is we're not going to put overtime in this plan because it's too risky. We have the ability to raise up the employee contributions if we do. If there's any transition benefits from people now in Tier 4 over to this plan, they have to pay the full actuarial cost for whatever service they built. Then during good times, we'll have reserves built up so that when the times are bad, we can utilize those reserves. The normal retirement age is going to have a age 55 and age 60 for these people rather than just the years of service rules. Page 10. So we've got this council, the Protective Occupational Retirement Council. We'll get that in a minute. They've got some features to adjust benefits as necessary. The contributions, the cost of living adjustments, the health care costs, and then the extra benefit formula that Mr. Westcott showed us. Page 12 is more specific on some of these decisions. This group is called the Protective Occupational Retirement Council. It will be like a board that will have difficult decisions year by year. Hopefully the decisions are that we've had a good year, can we do something? And we'll show some illustrations of how that might work. But annually they'll do a review. The actuarial will do some reports on kind of two bases, the target benefit basis and the guarantee benefit basis. But the bottom line is what you can see in the bottom line of page 12. There will be no change in the employer contribution rates. That's fixed. That's kind of the compromise here. So page 13 looks at some of the items that can be changed. I believe most of them Mr. Westcott talked about. I think the two bottom ones are huge, and as an actuary, I appreciate them more. The health reimbursement, for example, you know, we'll start off that we're only basing the premium reimbursement on the 2013 rates, but, you know, as the experience gets to be good, we'll bump that up to 2014, 2015. And the good news here is we're not going to have a lot of people retiring under this plan for many, many years. So by the time we have a meaningful number of retirees, we'll have a good experience and we'll know what we can do, what we can afford. Let me go to page 14. And I've been talking quickly. Is there a question at all at this point?
Nope, I'll interrupt when there is. Thanks.
Okay. I'll pause so you can cut in. All right, safeguard number two, of course, is my favorite, the actuarial methods. We've built in a margin for the actuarial assumptions. We'll use a asset valuation to kind of smooth things around, and again, we'll build up reserves. Page 15 is just the idea of the reduced discount rate. Let me just move forward. So page 16, we did some simulations. You know, we tried to look, what would have happened if we'd started in 1963 or 50 years ago or 20 years ago or whatnot. So we built this model that looked at, first of all, we got all the data from Alaska PERS, what your fund returns have been since 1981. And then we used some statistics before 1981. We got the state population, we used national wage statistics, and we kind of tried to model what the plan would have looked like. And page 17 is an example. As it turned out, 1985 was like an average case. So the plan would have started out on the bottom line, which is green. I don't know if you all have color or not. I can't. Yeah, it looks like you do. The bottom line is the funded ratio of the plan on the level of the target benefits. And as you can see, it starts right around 100% because you're funding what's necessary. And it would have bounced, it would have gone down in the late 80s. I guess there were a couple bad years. But then in the 90s, it would have skyrocketed. And by 2000, it would have been 130% funded. And then meanwhile, the guaranteed benefit level, which of course is lower level of benefits, that would have started out 120% funded. That would have skyrocketed up to 158% funded by 2000. But then the market tanked for a few years, went back up, tanked a lot in 2008. And so, for example, this plan, on a target benefit level by 2009, would have been only 80% funded. So we probably would have paid only out about the guaranteed benefit level around 2009. So every one of these years, this poor pension occupational retirement committee would have been making these tough decisions. During the 90s, when things they were booming, they probably would have ratcheted the benefits up to the guaranteed level. But as they started going down, perhaps they would have suspended the COLA for a few years in the early 2000s, and not granted the 2.5 instead of the 2.0. So they would have always been between these two lines. And by now, of course, they would have recovered, and we'd be paying benefits closer to the target benefit level. Page 18 is a ton of numbers, just showing how the case I just described was on the right. It started in 1985. Today it would be 93% funded on a target level of benefits, and 15 years in it would have been 134% funded. But then the bottom section shows on the guaranteed level, you know, the worst it ever would have been was 96% funded. The highest it would have been, as I said, was 158, but today it would have been 110% funded. Now, another thing to keep in mind is I showed kind of an extreme case with what's called the market value of assets. Actuaries, including your actuary, including me in most cases, uses a smooth value of assets to kind of smooth out the fluctuations. So if that was done, the funded ratios would have all, the good years would have been lower and the bad years would have been higher. That's kind of a typical actuarial technique. Page 19 is the best case, is if we started this 50 years ago. Now, I would have only been 5 years old, so I would have been able to help you out here, but if we'd started back in 1963, you know, this plan would have gotten up to 216% funded by the time the dot-com bubble burst on a guaranteed level, although probably we would have given all the benefits under the target level, so we would have been 180% funded. And then today, we'd be still be over 100. The worst case would have been if we started in 1996. So if we'd started in 1996, I'm sorry, I'm on page 20. I apologize. I hope Grace is keeping up with me. Did you all get to see page 19?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so page 20 was the worst case. So if we'd started in 1996, it would have been the worst. We would have been towards the end of this wonderful market run-up, but we wouldn't have had any money in the fund yet because we would have just started. So our funded ratios would have crept up to, 120-something, but then they would have plummeted, and then they would have plummeted again. So if we started in 1996, we would only be paying benefits at about the target level right now. Now, the good news is we wouldn't have had any retirees to speak of because 1996 is still less than 20 years ago. So we would be paying out benefits to the extent we are only at this guaranteed level if we had started in that year. The next four pages, I'm on page 21, and then the five pages beyond that talk about four states that do similar, what I call safeguard-related plans. I'll move very quickly through these. Unless you want more detail. Wisconsin on page 22, the main thing they do is their COLA is dependent on the fund returns. So every year they announce how much what they call the variable benefit is going to be. And it's all based on how well their returns in. They've got a formula built in, an actuarial formula. And sure enough, following this most recent crash, that variable benefit did decrease. Now, they've got something that you don't have. A retiree could actually have their benefit go down. It could never go down below what it was when they retired. But like if someone retired, say, in maybe 2005, their benefit would have gone up for a couple of years with the good returns. But then 2008, 2009, that piece might completely go away for them. In your case, we don't do that. The benefit can never go down. Once you're retired, your benefit's fixed. And then every year the PORC will make a decision as to whether a cost of living adjustment can be granted. I'm sorry, you call it a pension protection benefit. Same idea. Colorado Fire and Police, page 23, is also similar. Their contributions are fixed at 8% plus 8%. And I was their actuary starting in 1997, and we were having some good times. And what they did is if the plan was overfunded, they put the extra money into a DC account. And then, of course, that went away when the returns were bad. And they also have discretion over the cost of living adjustment. Same idea. They've got to keep their costs below 16%, just like you all would have to keep your costs below whatever 14 plus 9%. Now, keep in mind that that plan does not include health care. Very few plans, you probably know this, but very few plans around the country include health care as part of a pension. Health care is usually a separate entity. Page 24, South Dakota, a little bit like Wisconsin, they've got a cost of living adjustment that's variable. Page 25 is Ohio, and their contributions are now fixed. I was working for the legislature in Ohio, or Retirement Study Council, a legislative body. They made major pension reform in 2012, and basically those systems are required to keep their plans so that they'll be fully funded in 30 years. They're underfunded, most of them, but they have become fully funded in 30 years. And in most of those cases, they're imposing plan reductions. Particularly the police and fire plans have had some reductions in their benefits. And as I mentioned, they like you are one of the few that does include health care. I'm through with my tour around the country or the lower 48. Page 26, I believe Tom, this was in one of Tom's slides too. What we're trying to show here is that the 14% or the 12% employer contribution is fairly consistent with what other employers around the country and in Alaska provide, other larger employers provide. So like you see the bottom, Wells Fargo and Alaska Airlines are 12.2 and 14.7 when you add in everything for them. And then just to recap on page 27, because you have return on potential future unfunded liabilities, this is the main catalyst for designing this kind of a structure. The Tier 4, you know, is not anticipated to provide an adequate level of benefits, so this plan is a solution. If experience is as good as we expect, if we hit our 7% return on the average, then benefits will be pretty close to the Tier 3 benefits. But if experience is not so good, the benefits will be reduced, or will not be increased, I should say, to the Tier 3 level. Last bullet, I probably should explain this some more, but under a pure defined contribution plan, each individual takes the risk. Under a typical defined benefit plan, the employer takes the risk. And in this case, the risk is kind of shared among all of the individuals. So, you know, each individual doesn't have to figure out how long they're going to live. Each individual doesn't have to invest their own money. Each individual doesn't have to predict, you know, which asset classes is appropriate. The plan as a whole does it. So that takes a lot of the risk off the individuals. And that's the reason this kind of a structure works. At this point, I'm happy to take questions.
Any questions? Thanks again, Mr. Fournier, and you did get done and on time, and thanks again. And we are going to keep public testimony open, and with that, we're going to move on to the second bill. And I'd like to thank everybody that came today. And
is there no more public testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator's keeping it open. Except for people on the committee that have... Second item on the calendar today is House Bill 316, and to present that bill is Anna Latham from my staff. Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Anna Latham, staff to Representative Olson, and before you is House Bill 316, an act relating to the workers' compensation fees for medical treatment and services, relating to the workers' compensation regulations, and providing for an effective date. For the past decade, Alaska has struggled with the highest workers' comp rates in the nation. The Alaska Workers' Comp Board, the legislature, and the administration are all in agreement that effective reform is needed. House Bill 316 proposes to change the fee schedule for workers' comp claims to a schedule based on the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services rates, with a conversion factor set by the Workers' Comp Advisory Board. I'd like to briefly go over the sectional and then explain the bill in further detail. So Section 1 amends the physician, outpatient, and ambulatory surgical center and inpatient hospital fee schedules to be based on Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services fees. Section 2 refers to the fee schedule that's currently in statute. This section would go back into effect on January 1st of 2019. There is a sunset provision for this new schedule. And that is part of it. Section 3 requires the Workers' Comp Advisory Board to annually review and adjust fees under Section 1. It requires the board to set a conversion factor for the fee schedules in Section 1. It provides for maximum reimbursement for fees rendered in another state. It requires the board to set the rate for air ambulance service. It requires the board to set the markup and reimbursement limits for durable medical equipment. Requires the board to set the markup, dispensing fee, and reimbursement limits for prescription drugs. Requires a prescription drug dispensed by a physician to include in an invoice the code from the National Drug Code Directory published by the U.S. FDA. Section 4 lists reference materials the department may incorporate, including future amended versions, into regulations. And Sections 5 through 8 are part of the sunset clause, which I'll explain in a few minutes. So the fee schedule that we're using now is not working. In 2004, we established a UCR, Usual Customary and Reasonable Fee Schedule, that was set at the 90th percentile and reflective of the geographic area in which services were rendered. The UCR schedule has been in effect since 2004, and since 2004, Alaska's had the highest work comp rates in the nation. Medical costs constitute 76 cents of every dollar spent on workers' comp in Alaska, which has a serious impact on premium rates paid by all Alaskan employers. Medical costs have risen 25% over the past year, despite a 14% decline in the frequency of workers' comp claims over the same period. Our premiums are priced at 160% above the national median. High premiums are a drain on resources in both the public and private sectors. Clearly, the fee schedule we're using is not effective in reducing costs. Upward pressure is constantly applied to the UCR schedule. Once a fee schedule is published, charges tend to rise to and above the level of payment, which guarantees an annual increase in the UCR charges. So why switch to a resource-based relative value scale? This methodology was created in the late 80s by a team of researchers from Harvard, which included statisticians, physicians, and economists. They determined that each procedure was equated to a relative value unit that included a combination of the physician's work, practice expenses, and malpractice insurance. This system is owned and updated by the American Medical Association. The AMA assigns a relative value unit to each CPT, or current procedural technology code. And states that use the system commonly apply a geographic adjustment factor as well. The value is multiplied by a fixed conversion factor, which is a dollar amount that converts the relative value units into a payment amount for service. This is the basis for Medicare and Medicaid's payment schedule, and 32 states have adopted this methodology. House Bill 316 specifies that there's three fee schedules that will be used for workers' comp billing: a physician fee schedule, an outpatient and ambulatory surgical fee schedule, and an inpatient hospital fee schedule. The Workers' Comp Advisory Board would then be responsible for setting conversion factors for all of those three fee schedules and annually renewing and updating and adjusting fees. They'd also set the fee for air ambulance or medevacs. They'd set the markup for durable medical equipment. They'd set the dispensing fee and markup rates for reimbursement of prescription drugs. And there is a safety net in House Bill 316 in the form of a sunset provision. This gives the Workers' Comp Advisory Board 4 years to set the new rates and measure the success of those reforms. The new resource-based relative value scale and the conversion factors would go into effect January 1st of 2015. They would sunset January 1st, 2019. And Section 2, which is all of the old language using the UCR schedule, would go back into effect January 1st if the legislature did not take any action. So House Bill 316 is the first step in developing a solution to the escalating medical costs that Alaska is facing in their workers' comp system. The concepts introduced in this legislation were unanimously approved by the Workers' Comp Board this last September. There have been some concerns with the Workers' Comp Advisory Board setting the conversion factors, particularly their expertise in setting fee schedules. So there is another board, the Medical Services Review Committee, that's defined under 2330.095. Their mission is to assist and advise the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the board in matters involving appropriateness, necessity, and cost of medical and related services. It's a 9-member board. They haven't met since 2009. 4 of those members have medical expertise, and so there will be a CS with other suggestions, but primarily that medical board will be advising the Workers' Comp Advisory Board on setting conversion factors. And that CS will be up on the hearing scheduled for this coming Monday. So that concludes my introduction of House Bill 316. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I don't have a question, but I do have a brief statement, and that's that we, several months ago, we started contacting all the stakeholders that we could find and asked for advice and input onto what we were doing, and we've begun getting information back that's being incorporated into the CS. And any questions for Anna? Got off light. I'm going to open it up to public testimony, and it's my intent to be done by 5:30. So on that basis, we're going to try to limit it a bit, but we've got a lot of people signed up and a number of people in the room. John Bidney, it looks like you signed up first. Minutes, please. Or less.
I'll be very brief. My name is John Bitney, and I do work as a lobbyist in the building here. In this case, the client is the Alaska Surgery Center, and they prepared some written comments just prior to the hearing and just asked me to be present to provide those. I'll just be brief in saying that the concern that they expressed was having the board be a rate-setting entity, and I believe the staff has indicated that there'll be some provisions in the CS that'll come out. So I would just like to leave these here, but obviously we'll take a look at the CS and prepare some other comments in that regard. But I think that'll go a long ways towards addressing the concerns that they were asking to express. And I'll just leave the written comments with the committee, if that's okay.
Certainly.
Thank you.
And thanks, Ken. And that was, we drew that from several stakeholders. Tom Bryce. Thanks again, John. Tom's gone. We'll go outside the building now to Davis Peterson. Last Orthopedics. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, Davis C. Peterson, MD. I'm the president of the Alaska State Orthopedic Society.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
What's that?
I said thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Please continue.
Excuse me. Yes?
Oh, yeah. You had a prepared statement, I believe?
Yes, I left a written statement that includes most of the detail of what I've like to cover. I just have a few comments to clarify. Our society would prefer an RVRVS type unit or type of system for billing purposes, simply for administrative simplicity, and since the RVRVS system is maintained regularly for updating in codes and modifications of codes as technology develops, it's readily maintained, and in the past the problems have existed with private coding services and that were not maintained appropriately and fell out of date quickly. We would prefer a conversion factor system, and like some of the other stakeholders, including the Alaska State Medical Association, we would prefer that rate setting and conversion factor adjustment be completed by a separate entity, preferably made up of commission level individuals. Also, our society would prefer a possibly that if possible that some uniformity be developed among employers, stakeholders in terms of forms, paperwork, submissions, so that we're not dealing with multiple entities that make it difficult for us to handle the administrative changes. We're being faced with the ICD-10 changes this year that require us to adapt our software and our billing for Medicare purposes that will entail additional costs to our offices, hiring additional employees for coding. And it, as much as possible, if the system could be consistent with that, it would, I think, save us time, training, and money in the long run, would make us more efficient.
Well, thank you again, and we'll distribute your comments. And we're not planning on moving the bill today, believe me. There's a lot more work left on it. But thanks again for joining us today. Sally Strubeck, are you with us, Sally?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you. And good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. I'll be very brief given the time constraints. My name is Sally Strubeck. I'm the Human Resources Director for the Fairbanks Nor'easter Borough, and I oversee the Division of Risk Management, which handles the workers' comp benefit programs for both the borough and the school district, which are self-insured plans. We do continue to see increases in medical costs, and we believe that the changes that were proposed in this legislation are a step in the right direction, and we're in full support of those changes. The Fairbanks Nor'easter Borough Administration and the Assembly does support the components of the Workers' Comp Board adopted resolution that they worked on back in September of 13, and we have provided a letter of support and also the resolution that the Assembly adopted in support. And so that really concludes what I have to say. Thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to speak on this legislation and also the earlier workers' comp legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your support as well. Dave Jones, Solana.
Good afternoon, Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is Dave Jones, and I am the Assistant Superintendent for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. I have previously testified to this committee on House Bill 41 related to the large medical cost increases our workers' compensation plan has been experiencing, so I will not repeat that testimony today. The fee schedules within the House Bill 316 are a good start towards addressing our medical cost concerns. I would like to see treatment guidelines developed to regulate usage as well. I want to thank you for the considering a bill that will help control our workers' compensation costs and urge you to move this bill forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Well, thank you, Dave. And we are working in that direction as well, but it'll be next year on the issue you brought up. Julie Sisco.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. I am Julie Sisco. I am the risk manager for the Kenai Peninsula Borough and School District. I will second everything Mr. Jones said. Any steps that we can make to start getting some costs under control will be greatly appreciated, and we will continue to support this. Thank you.
Thanks again, Julie. Dave Kester, Anchorage. Are you with us, Dave?
I am. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, yeah, you're coming through clear.
All right, perfect. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. My name is Dave Kester, for the record. I'm a commercial insurance broker, have been for about 18 years. Before that, I was a workers' compensation underwriter for an insurance company. I'm also a 10-year member of the Workers' Compensation Board, and the governor has just appointed me to the fourth term, and hopefully you'll see my name to be submitted before you here shortly to approve my fourth term. As a disclaimer, I'm here I'm not here to represent the entire Work Comp Board, nor am I testifying on behalf of the board, but I am a member of the board, and I was a member of the working group that Mr. Chairman had mentioned that this summer went to Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Kenai, and Juneau, and heard from a wide array of stakeholders, including large and small employers, members of labor, medical providers, adjusters, attorneys, etc. Many members of the public expressed their concern for the rising medical costs and workers' compensation. And as a result of that, the board did adopt Resolution 1301 to support addressing system costs under the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act, of which House Bill 316 is taking a lot of those into account. And so I obviously support this bill. I'm glad that that you are taking this up with these kind of escalating medical costs that were mentioned before by Annie. This is not sustainable under the current system, and a different medical fee methodology as presented in HB 316, this will have a big impact, and without it, rates are going to, I'm fearing, increase for employers and make them uncompetitive and our state uncompetitive. The legislators and legislative intent for the Workers' Compensation Act was to ensure the quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of indemnity and medical benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers. And we're getting to a point where a reasonable cost is far exceeding for employers. I would like the committee, ask the committee to carefully consider the sunset clause, fixing the problem and then going back to a methodology that has got us to the problem in the first place seems counterproductive to me. There may be other things, but I just ask the committee to look at that in the future. I also advocate for implementing evidence-based treatment guidelines and encourage the committee to consider that and implement that into the bill. And additionally, as a board member, the concern raised or the suggestion to get the input from the Medical Services Review Committee to help the board and make recommendations to the board is a very good idea. I support that as well. I admit that we're not medical experts, and the board had considered seeking that kind of expertise when we were putting our resolution together. So appreciate the time and your efforts in trying to fix the system.
once again, Dave. Chuck Brady.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Chuck Brady. I am the president of the Workers' Compensation Committee of Alaska. I'm also workers' comp manager at Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, primarily responsible for workers' compensation in the lower 48, but I'm very much involved with what's going on up here in Alaska. We submitted a letter today on behalf of the WCCA, voicing our support of House Bill 316 with some suggestions. The suggestions are consistent with what you've previously heard, and that is that input by the Medical Services Review Committee is probably a good idea, since they've got some medical expertise on there. The other suggestions that we made is that the fee schedule alone is not going to get us where we need to be. Experience in the claims field is that every state where we've seen fee schedules introduced as a means of controlling costs, they have a limited effect, and it's for a short period of time until medical providers have figured a way to bill around it. Medical fee schedules alone are not effective, but they can be if they're also introduced with utilization review. Utilization and frequency standards to control what is being given in the way of treatment. We also think that there needs to be addressed or some modification to AS 2330-095A, which and to deal with the effects of the Hibden decision, which the Supreme Court came down with in 1999, that essentially gave treating doctors a blank check for 2 years to do whatever that they see fit, with no real recourse by employers or insurance carriers to question what was being done or do anything to limit the cost within the first 2 years. And then finally, the sunset clause is of concern to us as well, because we're concerned that the attitude may be when this is passed that, okay, we've got the fee schedule in place, problem solved, our work here is done, and then in 4 years it sunsets and we're right back where we started. So, but given those comments, we do support House Bill 316, and we look forward to seeing it pass.
Thanks again, Chuck, and I think there are a couple more components that will be coming out shortly, but again, we've got a full calendar for next year on things like best practices for pain management, any number of things that will be components that will interface with what we're doing right now, but it couldn't be done in one bill. But thanks again. Rachel Petro. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rachel Petro, and I serve as the President and CEO of the Alaska Chamber. And we represent hundreds of businesses across Alaska, as you are well aware, as well as local chambers that, of course, represent even more businesses. We did submit a letter that articulated all of our concerns, but just want to emphasize today to the committee members who are there how important workers' compensation reform is to Alaska businesses. It is a top priority for the Alaska Chamber and all of our members. It's a competitiveness issue, and we just really appreciate the committee introducing the bill, and do believe that we have offered some recommendations in our letter to improve the bill, and you've already indicated, Mr. Chairman, that you're working on some of those. To be specific, we would like to see more policy direction given to the board in regard to what the goal is of giving them the responsibility of setting the fee schedules. Additionally, we would like to see a robust and defined public process for the promulgation of regulations through the board. I will ditto comments earlier regarding adoption of evidence-based treatment guidelines as well as utilization review standards. And then finally, we do view the Medical Services Review Committee as a great option to help advise the Workers' Comp Board in setting the fees. So with that, I will leave you with, you have our letter, I believe it's already on the record, so thank you very much for your work on this, and we look forward to working with you to achieve real reform on workers' comp in Alaska. Thanks.
Oh, thanks again, Rachel. Sarah Lefebvre, questions only, work comp board. We have another work comp board member online. Any questions? Nope. Thanks for being with us, Sarah, if you're still there.
Yes, I am.
Oh, thanks again. Or do you have a comment that you want to make?
Yeah, I can comment, too, if there are no questions, and that is that I also sit on the workers' comp board with Dave Kester and agree with his comments, most particularly the comment regarding the sunset clause. I think that that type of mechanism is just not effective.
Could we just hop on the record? Name and affiliation again?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sarah Lefebvre, and I work for Exclusive Paving and University Ready Mix in Fairbanks, which are Colaska companies, and I also sit on the workers' comp board.
Oh, thanks. Oh, please continue.
And then I would add to my comments that I don't disagree that there are further changes that are important and should happen, but I believe that this is an excellent bill and an excellent start, and I would discourage the addition of any changes that could possibly impede its progress. I would love to see this go through the session and then additional work done later. And my only question in the legislation as it's presented is the sunset clause. So
we're looking at that, and I thank you for your concerns about getting it done in one session. I think that's our goal, is getting this component done.
And that's all I have, unless anybody has questions, which I'm more than happy to assist.
Well, thanks again. Karen Perdue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Karen Perdue, CEO and President of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And as you know, hospitals and nursing homes are large private sector employers, so we do bear the burden of workers' compensation costs. And so as employers and also healthcare providers, we do support the concept of workers' comp fee reform. And on behalf of hospitals, we are willing, where it makes sense, to even be paid less than we are today. However, we do have a few concerns about the fees and the rates and how they would be set as laid out in the bill. It might seem easy to use Medicare and multiply those rates and adjust them geographically, but hospitals are paid, hospitals and nursing homes are paid in five different ways under Medicare law. And it didn't seem like a good idea, Mr. Chairman, to spend Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock going through all of those five ways. So I'll just hit the very, very highest lights on those. Because we do have a letter that we have produced for the committee that does go into more detail.
You only got one thing, Karen. Your office is about 100 feet from mine.
Yes, thank you very much.
But typically you're about 100 feet from my office, so please come over next week and we can...
And I thank you for the outreach that you've given us already. But just in terms of the highlights, you know, Medicare is such a poor payer in Alaska for our big PPS hospitals, our Providence, Alaska Regional, Fairbanks, others, Kenai, Bartlett. And so when we see Medicare as the cost base and there's an undefined multiplier in the bill, it gives us a lot of heartburn because Medicare pays about 30 cents on the dollar in Alaska. And so I think that we really need some reassurance in the process, and we had determined that commercial rates, those rates that Aetna and Premera and others pay, might be a target that the committee could look at to provide us some sort of minimum or backstop in this discussion. The second point I wanted to make was on the critical access hospitals. Those are 13 of our small hospitals in Alaska, and the Congress has already exempted them basically from Medicare fee schedules. They have a very special exemption that basically says that they will not be able to keep their doors open based on volume, and so they have a cost-based reimbursement system. So Idaho, for instance, exempts COS from their workers' comp Medicare-based fee schedule. So we would recommend that that be the case in Alaska. Skilled nursing facilities, another issue And I think our letter outlines that as well as for tribals. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your interest in this subject, and we stand ready to work with you.
See you next week. Have a good weekend. Greg Millis?
Yes, hi. My name is Greg Millis, and I am the owner and physical therapist at Hometown Physical Therapy, a small private outpatient clinic. And I'd like to basically support what Karen had just kind of addressed in the previous statement, but I guess treading lightly on going through this process, as again we're kind of basing this right now as far as our knowledge goes off of the Medicare fee schedule, and in the state lower 48 states this same kind of practice has occurred in other insurance issues, and small practices as well as even large facilities are starting to minimize the amount of health care exposure that they're going to give to Medicare, and this is slowly translating up to Alaska, but very likely could be impacted greatly if this does, you know, follow the Medicare standards as far as fee schedules go. I would see that other practices in this state would also minimize how much health care coverage they're going to be providing for the workers' compensation patients, which is going to minimize their health care and how quickly these patients return to care. So I guess, again, just treading lightly, and the reassurance of what the fee schedule is going to be would be a great help as you go through this process. Again, I don't turn down the bill. I think that fee control is a huge issue, but I think that we also have to be very concerned about how quickly we go about that. And that's really the point I wanted to make today. Thank you for your time.
And again, I'll say a work in progress, and we're getting a lot of feedback, and it helps. Ruth Carlson.
My name is Ruth Carlson. I also am a small private physical therapy practice here in Fairbanks, and I agree with both Karen and Greg. And with our current Medicare and Medicaid fee schedule, it is getting harder and harder to run my business with increasing of those clients. And so if we have another entity that is going toward those schedules, we're really going to have to limit the amount of clients that we see, frankly, in order to keep our doors open. So as a business owner, I'm an employer too, so I understand the need for reform. But as a healthcare provider, I feel like I'm having to work harder and harder and harder to keep my doors open. So that is my concern.
Well, thank you again for joining us today. Walker Parrish.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Walker Parrish here, Fairbanks. I feel that as an individual, that cutting these costs is going to interfere with my medical health care, and along with the prescriptions provided by the physicians. I think it is a savings to the Workman's Comp Board to have that into effect. My old saying is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Thank you for your time. Have a nice day.
Yeah, thank you for joining us today. Julie Amend?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Juliana Amend. I'm a small business owner of North Pole Physical Therapy. I'm a healthcare provider as a physical therapist and a member of the Alaska chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. I'd like to say that while the Alaska Physical Therapy Association supports the efforts to reform and improve this workman's compensation system, we have a number of questions and concerns about the proposed bill language. The proposal is broad and far-reaching and may have serious ramifications if all of its implications are not fully vetted nor understood. I urge that you proceed with caution, again, reflecting what Greg and what Ruth Carson had to say. The proposed RBRVS-based system may not be ideal for Alaska. The proposed workman's comp fee schedule, which would have its foundation in the Medicare physician fee schedule, which is a fundamentally flawed and broken system, I'm not sure it's a good fit for what we're doing now. As a business owner, it's taken only focused management strategies and some cost shifting in my clinic to be able to continue to see patients whose payers are currently using an RVS system like Medicare. This bill looks like it has a five-year sunset, but 5 years would greatly affect my small business's ability to continue to see workman's comp patients in North Pole. Given the potential for unintended consequences and some of the ramifications this bill could potentially have on small business health care providers and the patients that I see, I strongly recommend the legislation be turned over to a study committee to fully investigate all the variables and potential outcomes that may result from its implementation. And I have a statement in writing that I'll put in as the record.
Oh, excellent, because I was going to ask that you can be part of the solution if you have something in writing along with the other people that have testified that still may be listening that haven't sent anything. And believe me, it's helping us. But I think we're going to see something this year because we're still number 50 and we're going to be number 50 next year as far as rates go if we don't do something. But thanks again for joining us. And Richard Cobden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Richard Cobden. I am an orthopedic surgeon. I am also a solo practitioner and an immediate past chief of staff at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and a member of the Alaska Orthopedic and Alaska State Medical. I have two problems with this bill. One is that the CMS, RVS, Medicare-based fee schedule is going to be a really big problem with me and my colleagues. Most of us are barely getting by, even though you're saying that our reimbursement rates are so high. In fact, a lot of the CMS reimbursement rate is going to change. In fact, on April 1st, it will revert back 26% lower rates than they are right now because of problems that Congress is having. Basing it on that kind of a reimbursement system can be a catastrophe for Alaska. Secondly, the AWP, average wholesale price for medications, has always been used for reimbursement for prescription meds, and it really should continue because the actual invoice price, which is in the bill, is significantly lower. We will no longer be able to give prescription meds to patients, which is a great convenience for them. I would like you to consider, when you finish this bill, both the basic reimbursement rate, the Medicare rate, and these other rates, before you decide that Alaska is just like the rest of the other 50 states. We are not. We have big problems here. We have very difficult medical and orthopedic problems with patients who are injured, and we really have an obligation to take care of them. I want to continue to do this, but my colleagues have told me if the CMS rates drop, if the workers' comp rates drop, they're just not going to see these patients. And that's a huge problem for our patients that should be our number one priority.
Dr. Cobden, will you take a question?
I'd love to take a question.
Representative Reinbold.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking time. I know how hectic medical offices can be, so thank you for taking time to testify. Can you get us your testimony and outline these concerns, especially the April 1st, when the rates are dropping by 26%? If you can get us that, we'd really appreciate that.
I will certainly do that. I've already prepared a written statement, and I'll add to it if I can do it after this hearing.
Perfect. Yeah, thanks again for joining us, Doctor. Deborah Mersch.
Yes, my name is Deborah Mersch, and I'm here representing Willow Physical Therapy, a small physical therapist office here in Fairbanks. And I just wanted to just stand beside all that has spoken here today. And we disagree with this bill, and we will hope you consider the small physical therapist practices here in Fairbanks so that we can stay open and be able to provide medical care that they need. Thank you.
Thanks again. Is there anybody else online? And again, we're going to keep public testimony open. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, we will hold the bill over and adjourn at 5:25.